Chapter 8. Betrayal. "What, you again?" said Monsieur Henri, chief of the criminal department of the Paris police. "I told you that if I saw you again, you'd go back to the galleys." The man who stood between two gendarmes was short, powerfully built, with a scarred face and a jaw like a lion. His name was Eugène François Vidocq, and he was 34 years old. When Vidocq had last visited Monsieur Henri's office a few months earlier, it had been to make the police chief an offer. Vidocq had been in trouble all his life. He had escaped from prison half a dozen times, and for the past 10 years had been running an old clothes business in Paris. But he had been recognised by former associates, and now they were blackmailing him. His offer? To betray half a dozen wanted criminals in exchange for immunity from the police. Henri had refused the offer, yet he had allowed Vidocq to walk out of his office a free man. He knew Vidocq would be back sooner or later, and that he would be able to drive a harder bargain. It happened on the morning of July the 1st, 1809. Vidocq had been betrayed to the police by his in-laws and had been on the run for 2 months. Henri told the gendarme to wait outside, and then he leaned forward. "You offered to help us. Very well, you can help us." Vidocq tried not to show delight. "You mean I can go free?" "No, you must go to prison, to the Bicêtre." And he explained his needs. A burglar called Barthélemy Lacour, known as Coco, was in the Bicêtre. He had stolen a large quantity of silver. The silver had been recovered and Coco was now awaiting trial, but there was no evidence against him. What Henri wanted was for Vidocq to get the evidence. It sounded a fairly unimportant task, but Vidocq was not taken in. He knew that once he had provided Henri with this evidence, that would not be the end. Henri wanted a police spy to work among the prisoners of the Bicêtre, one of the most dangerous of all tasks. If a prisoner was even suspected of being a spy, he would be found dead the next morning. Few criminals were willing to take the risk, but Vidocq realised he had no choice, for he was at the end of his tether. And this is a matter that requires some explanation. There are many criminals who would be glad of a chance to become an honest citizen, but crime has trapped them like an octopus, and if they free themselves from one tentacle, another winds around the wrist or the ankle. Vidocq was in this situation. He had never committed a serious crime. He had simply been a daring and violent young man who landed in jail for the first time on a charge of being a public nuisance. He had caught his mistress with an officer and had beaten them both up. Because he had felt the sentence was unjust, he had been an intractable prisoner and got into more trouble. He escaped, was forced to steal, and was recaptured. He escaped again and became famous for escaping. During one of his periods of freedom, he became involved with a gang known as the Chauffeur, the Warmers. These men made a habit of bursting into lonely farms at night and torturing the inhabitants to make them confess the whereabouts of their valuables. They often hung their victims upside down over a fire, hence the nickname. Vidocq may well have become a member, although he always insisted that he merely slept with the mistress of one of the chauffeurs and that she helped him to obtain false papers. The pattern is familiar. We can see it in the career of the mass murderer Karl Panseram, executed in 1931, whose journal, Killer, is one of the most horrific documents in the history of criminology. Panseram was a highly dominant man. His reaction to prison and ill-treatment was wild rage, resulting in more crimes, murders committed to get his own back on society. Yet it's possible to pity Panseram. Given his temperament and the forces against him, he never stood a chance. There are thousands of criminals in his position, and a few of them see the one possible road leading to escape from the downward spiral, the road Vidocq saw, to become a police spy. Vidocq went into the Bicêtre, and his reputation as an escaper made him a hero. He actually saved the life of the man he was there to betray. Coco was suspected of being a police spy, and it was Vidocq who vouched for him to the other prisoners. After that, the grateful Coco felt Vidocq was an intimate friend. He told him the story of the stolen silver, and confided that the police had no evidence against him. The only man who had seen him with the stolen property was a porter in the Rue Dauphine. At his trial, Coco was astounded when the porter appeared in court to give evidence against him. He was sentenced to the maximum term of imprisonment. By that time, Vidocq had already betrayed innumerable other criminals to justice. His powerful physique and his reputation as an escaper made him popular among the prisoners. They were all delighted when, nearly 2 years later, Vidocq escaped yet again on his way to court. No one guessed that this time the police had contrived his escape. Vidocq was lucky in more ways than one. A career of betrayal and double-dealing is an unpleasant existence, which is likely to induce the kind of carelessness that no police spy can afford. But Vidocq was a born detective. His nostrils twitched with pleasure when the game was afoot. Faced with a problem that the police had been unable to solve, Vidocq worked at it with a savage persistence that usually brought results. For example, the police wanted to get hold of a forger named Vatrine, who had escaped from them some time before. Through patient inquiry at rooming houses, Vidocq discovered that a man answering Vatrine's description had left some of his possessions in a rented room. Vidocq and his mistress moved into the room next door. Weeks later, they heard someone in the next room. Vatrine had returned, also with a mistress. Vidocq burst in, but the wiry counterfeiter managed to dodge past him and out into the night. By means of blood-curdling threats, Vidocq persuaded the abandoned mistress to give him her regular address. Vidocq was there within minutes and saw a shadowy figure dodge back into the house. Vatrine. He chased Vatrine up the stairs, and the forger turned and, with the skill of an Apache, dealt Vidocq a tremendous kick in the chest. Then he locked himself inside a room. Vidocq decided to try cunning. In a loud voice, he ordered his mistress, Annette, to go for the police. Then he clattered down the stairs himself, removed his shoes, and tiptoed back up again. When Vatrine eased his head cautiously around the door, he was seized by the hair and dragged to the nearest gendarmerie. One more example of multiple betrayal will suffice to give an idea of the way Vidocq became Paris's most successful manhunter. One day, in 1811, Vidocq was approached by a thief named Otto, whom he had helped to arrest some time before. Otto said that he wanted to become a police spy, and he advised Vidocq that certain wanted pickpockets would be at the Fête de Saint-Cloud the following evening. When Vidocq arrived with some police agents, Otto appeared and told him regretfully that several thieves had recognised him and fled. The next morning, Vidocq learned that a number of thefts had been committed on the other side of the Saint-Cloud area. Vidocq had contributed to the success of the robbery by borrowing local police to help him arrest the non-existent pickpockets. He realised that Otto had betrayed him, but he said nothing and he bided his time. In fact, he appeared to become very friendly towards Otto. One day, some weeks later, returning from an all-night vigil with another agent, Vidocq passed Otto's room. He decided to drop in casually. Otto was still in bed. Vidocq produced a bottle, and all three had a drink. When he reported to Monsieur Henri later in the day, Henri told him that there had been a big lead robbery in the night. Four men had stolen a quantity of lead from a half-built house. "I know one of them," said Vidocq. He had noticed that Otto's shoes were muddy and that his clothes were damp. Obviously, he'd been out all night. Vidocq bought a cold chicken and called on Otto again, announcing that he had come to lunch. They ate the meal sitting on the bed. Otto was still not dressed. Vidocq casually dropped his hat on Otto's shoes, then asked his assistant if he would mind slipping out with a message. The assistant departed with Otto's spiked shoes concealed under his coat. Otto had no desire to get up. He and Vidocq were halfway through a bottle of brandy, and when they were alone, Otto said that he could betray three men who had committed a big lead robbery the night before. Otto was proposing to betray his three associates. Moreover, if he did so, he would probably escape trial for aiding the police. Vidocq was determined that this should not happen, so he asked Otto if he would help him spy on a certain prisoner in the local jail. Otto, eager to ingratiate himself, agreed, and so Vidocq was able to leave him safely locked in a prison cell while he went round to round up the other three. He had no idea where to find them, but he had another piece of useful information. Otto had two mistresses. Vidocq found one of them in a bar, and he bought her a drink. Then he mentioned that he had just left Otto with the other mistress. Within half an hour, she had not only told him many of the incriminating things about Otto, she had led him to the rooms of the three other thieves. Vidocq picked them up and told them that Otto had intended to betray them. They immediately declared that it was Otto who had planned the robbery. When all four thieves appeared in the same dock, Vidocq had his revenge on Otto for the double cross at Saint-Cloud. Vidocq was so spectacularly successful that he was soon given his own police department. It was called the Sûreté, and for more than 20 years Vidocq ran the Sûreté in his own inimitable way, using his intimate knowledge of the underworld and relying heavily on a complex net of informers, all known to one another. He was the founder of a method that has become a basic part of modern police work. When he left the Sûreté, due to political intrigues, Vidocq scored another first when he became a private inquiry agent, the first private detective in Europe. He also became a close friend of the novelist Balzac, supplying ideas for Balzac's plots. Balzac repaid him by turning Vidocq into one of the most powerful creations of his own, the master criminal Vautrin. Vidocq died in 1857 at the age of 82, one of the few criminals who managed to free himself from the tentacles of the underworld and to achieve a less dubious kind of celebrity. The story of Vidocq demonstrates an adage known to every policeman, that there is no honour among thieves. The thief is basically a chancer, a man who is in the business because he holds the naive belief that life ought to give him something for nothing. If he thinks he can get away with something, he'll try. His criterion is success, not honour. That is one reason that the police never seem to have difficulty in finding informers, also known as narcs, snouts and grasses, in spite of the danger of the profession. The narc is not well paid. He may be lucky if he receives £20 for a tip-off that might cost him his life, but he has the satisfaction of feeling that he is not wholly an outcast, a member of the underworld. And this is, psychologically speaking, the most interesting aspect of the informer. When a man is young, crime comes to him easily. A child is always wanting things it cannot have, and its desires are so strong that it doesn't greatly care by what means they're satisfied. A teenager feels an outcast from society anyway. He's expected to start playing a responsible role in a world he did nothing to create, and his basic feeling about the world is usually one of rejection, what Marx called alienation. He also begins to experience powerful sexual urges, an undiscriminating desire to undress and possess every pretty girl he sees. And if he happens to be good-looking and charming, he may be able to play the successful Don Juan. Yet, although his seductions are perfectly legal, provided the girl is above the age of consent, he's still basically stealing what he wants, because he's taking it without any thought of return. Most rapists are under the age of 20, and rapists above the age of 30 are rare. Those few are psychopaths or near-psychopaths. The reason for all this is that after the age of 20 or so, the adult human being starts to experience a certain feeling of oneness with the community. If he's married, he probably goes out with other couples and invites them back to his house or flat, and the world ceases to be alien. He may still have a highly flexible morality. He may think nothing of buying a pair of tyres he knows to be stolen or seducing his wife's best friend, but he begins to feel himself a part of society. And if he has a reasonable job and a home, he enters the stage of development that Abraham Maslow calls the self-esteem stage. He wants to be liked and respected by other people. It is possible for a criminal to be liked and accepted, particularly if he happens to be an Al Capone or a Reggie Cray, but it's not easy. Generally speaking, it's true that crime comes naturally only to the young. As a man approaches 30, he begins to dream of a solid, comfortable future, for, paradoxically, what he now wants mostly is the protection of society. A criminal who, because of an inborn tendency to violence or because he cannot break the habit of crime, continues to feel himself an outcast as he approaches middle age, also begins to develop suicidal tendencies, a sense of futility. Many old lags commit crimes that are so stupid that they seem to want to be caught. Karl Panzram, who had spent most of his life in and out of prisons, committed a murder in jail and then firmly blocked all attempts to get him a reprieve. He wanted to die. The informer, then, is trying to re-establish this link with society, to escape the vicious circle. This aspect of the psychology of the narc has never been adequately recognised by criminal psychologists. There is, of course, a simpler and less familiar form of criminal betrayal, when thieves fall out. This usually seems to happen when the relation between thieves or murderers is one of dominance. It happened in the case of Burke and Hare, the infamous body snatchers. Burke, the dancing master, was the brains of the pair, and he dominated the tall, cadaverous Hare. But when they were finally caught, almost red-handed, after the murder of a beggar woman called Doherty, it was Hare who turned King's evidence and thus saved his own neck. Burke alone was hanged in 1829. Hare went to the Midlands, and there's a story that when fellow workers in the lime kiln discovered his identity, they threw lime in his eyes, blinding him. He certainly died as a blind old beggar in London. In the equally famous or infamous case in which Mr. William Weir was murdered near Elstree, all the three accomplices tried to pass the blame from one to the other. Weir was a gambler who had won a large sum of money from the well-known sportsman John Turtle. Turtle and two associates called Joseph Hunt and William Probert took Weir to a cottage in Gills Hill Lane, where Turtle murdered him by shooting him and then cutting his throat with a penknife. The next morning, local labourers became suspicious when they saw two strange-looking characters searching the undergrowth near the cottage, and when Turtle and Hunt had gone back indoors, the labourers found the blood-stained knife and the pistol lying on top of a wall. They reported the find to a magistrate, and the body of William Weir was soon discovered in the nearby pond. The case caused a nationwide sensation, out of all proportion to its interest. Probert and Hunt both tried to turn King's evidence, but Probert beat Hunt to it, and finally only Turtle and Hunt were tried. Hunt's speech in his own defence was mostly a whine about having been promised immunity if he cooperated with the law. As to Turtle, he made an impressive speech declaring that he was a gentleman and incapable of murder, and that the real murderer was Hunt. This was undoubtedly a lie. Turtle was hanged in front of the largest crowd that had ever gathered to watch a man being turned off, while Hunt was reprieved and transported to Australia, where he lived to a ripe old age. Of more recent cases involving betrayal, the most psychologically interesting is that of the Manson family. The followers of Charles Manson regarded him as a saviour, and often pointed out that his name meant the Son of Man. Consequently, there is an element of ritual drama in his betrayal of one of his mistresses, Susan Atkins. The betrayal was not entirely deliberate. The family was under arrest for car stealing, and no one suspected that they might be the killers of Sharon Tate and the LaBiancas. Apparently out of boredom, or a desire to impress, Susan Atkins began to drop hints about the murders to her cellmate, who passed it on to another prisoner, who informed the police. At the subsequent trial, she was undoubtedly regarded as the central figure, next to Manson himself. The rest of the family certainly regarded her as a Judas. It seems clear that her unintentional betrayal of Manson was less accidental than it looked. She had been feeling rebellious about him for some time before the arrest. It has been suggested that she felt he needed a Judas to enable him to fulfil his destiny as a victim of society. But this is probably placing too complicated a construction on her motive. One interesting comparison emerges with the Turtle case. Many contemporaries declared that Turtle's eloquence was deeply moving, and obviously felt that he should not have been executed. Similarly, many commentators in the West Coast underground press seemed to feel that Manson was being unfairly treated. His murders were a protest against the establishment, and he was, in some arcane sense, innocent. The fact remains that Turtle's moving speech consisted mostly of lies, as did Manson's own defence. What's so interesting is that many apparently decent, sane people should take the side of a murderer. And the explanation is that, although in practical terms they may be law-abiding citizens, there is an element of social immaturity about them that makes them take the side of the lonely but criminal individual against society. The lesson to be drawn is that there is a great deal of muddled thinking and muddled feeling in our society about crime. Educationalists might include a history of murder in every school curriculum.